wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 31st Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews John Cavanna, director of the large and influential Institute for Policy Study for 20 years. Cavanna has written 12 books and worked in the trenches of the environmental and poor people's movements. John and Bill analyzed the Biden administration American Jobs Plan and whether left movements allied with the Congressional Progressive Caucus can summon up the will and capacity to gain substantial funds for developing multiple carbon zero cities. In the final segment of a three-part interview, Luisa Martinez and Dr. Mitch Green return to the way economists frame the economic problem, that is, of understanding the dynamics of a social provisioning process. They discuss what the heterodox school of economics has to say about the possibilities for a non-capitalist economy. We will link to parts one and part two. Again, this will be the third and final part. And we'll conclude today's program with Sharon Grant looking at vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers. Sharon was a longtime public employee with Multnomah County and worked on vaccine hesitancy community campaigns for the health department. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and John Cavanna.
Hi, John Cavanna. Welcome to KBOO again.
Fantastic to be with you, Bill.
John Cavanna directed the large, influential Institute for Policy Studies for 20 years, is now a senior advisor at IPS. He knows Washington from the inside out, wrote some 12 books, the most recent co-author just released The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Save the Country from Corporate Greed. He's also worked in the trenches in environmental and poor people's movements. In this interview, John Cavanna analyzes the Biden American Jobs Plan, the multiple trillion-dollar proposal likely to pass in some form that functions as his administration's stimulus, a combination of goals, stimulus, COVID relief, and infrastructure program and jobs program. It features something for everyone, including many billions for the coal industry and nuclear power industries, and hundreds of billions for highways and bridges and for the auto industry in developing their clean green electric cars. Certainly when all the squabbling and fighting is over, when it gets through the Congress after the lobbyists do their work, U.S. corporations will be first in line for much of the funding. But that's only part of the story. The interview today also addresses whether left movements allied with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, can they sum up the will, the capacity to gain substantial funds, hundreds of billions actually, and use to demonstrate how, to create programs to demonstrate how humankind can succeed through a radically democratic and just reconstruction of the way we produce, consume, and live. John Cavanna, tell us about Biden administration's American Jobs Plan.
Sure, and thank you, Bill. It's great to be with you. Just one word of context for the Biden plan that's so important and that all your listeners have been living. We've just been through 14 months of a global pandemic, which has turned the world on its head. So what used to be conventional wisdom for the preceding 50 years, I think it's probably smart for us to throw out the window. We're in a new ball game. Now, as you pointed out, we still have big corporate interests trying to get goodies out of the government. That hasn't changed. We still have Wall Street. We still have big military contractors. But I think for most people in this country and the world, we emerge from this pandemic with a bunch of new, radically different insights. The pandemic has exposed how incredibly unequal this country is. Both in class terms, we've watched the billionaires get $1.3 trillion richer in the pandemic, while ordinary workers have suffered. And also across race, we've watched black and brown workers be disproportionately hit both by the economic crisis and by COVID. And this has been apparent to everyone. And keep in mind, the pandemic follows a year of brilliant organizing in progressive circles around the climate emergency, the whole emergence of a climate youth movement. So we walk into this debate with Joe Biden, who's proposing some things, put some proposals on the table, I think with people having a much deeper sense that we have a government that for many years has favored fossil fuels over clean energy, that has favored Wall Street over Main Street, and less apparent but equally deep, a government that has favored the military with over half of its discretionary funding over basic human needs. So that's a strength. We walk into it, I think, with a country understanding the need for major change and wanting it. And by the way, that's part of what conditioned what Joe Biden has put on the table. I just want to remind all your listeners that last year, when Bernie Sanders pulled out of the race, he said, I'll pull out quietly if you agree to six major commissions between your people and my people. And out of that, there were months of fascinating debate on climate, on the economy, on health care, on other issues, where Bernie's people put forward the radical ideas that Bernie ran on, like the Green New Deal, and where the Biden people accepted a bunch of them. They accepted them. I don't know whether they believed in them or not. They knew that to win in the election, they needed the Bernie voters. So Joe Biden learned these issues. He learned the Green New Deal. He gave a major address on the need for that kind of transformation. He committed himself to it, and then he's elected. So we come into this year with Biden having made big promises. I think also the Biden people understand that this is a big transformative moment and that it needs big solutions. And so the plans he put forward are big and bold. They're bigger than anything that's been put forward by government ever before. It's a big jobs plan and what he calls the American Families Plan. These are hundreds of billions of dollars in investment in everything, as you say. I mean, everything's in there, you're right. So there's some bad stuff in there, like coal, like too much spending on highways and so on. And then there's some great stuff in there. A lot of money that will go into the energy transition, a lot of money that will go into jobs. The American Families Plan, a lot of money that will go into making child care affordable in this country, and in these plans, paying for them by taxing corporations and wealthy individuals. So getting at the imbalance, if you will, between Wall Street and Main Street. So I do want everybody to know that these are big, bold plans, and they include a lot of progressive priorities as well as some things that progressives won't like so much.
Yeah, I'm afraid, John, that as things go on, it's easy to make promises. It's even easy to spend $1 billion here and there on some small demonstration project that the left is seeking. I think, though, in this bargaining, we have to be very careful and also, as I pointed out, be very radical in supporting the Congressional Progressive Caucus, not just supporting them, but in fact making clear that they have to get together and carry their weight. And on the other hand, the Congress is made up of 400 or 500 people.
Right.
Maybe 100 of them are progressives. 400 are, in fact, the same people who have so enriched the companies in the past and dined with their lobbyists. I think it's going to be very hard, and especially with regard to climate change, it's going to be very hard to make sure that the package doesn't give such great funds to, for example, the investor-owned utilities who really want to wipe out local Democratic energy, have done everything they can and have not yet succeeded. But
right,
with a good with congressional grants of enough money, they could build out their system so they could still dominate the American electrical, American power system, which is their goal. I think it's very worrisome when you think about the people who are making the decisions and the regulators who are making the decisions, who have shown themselves in the past to be very friendly to corporate interests, that we're going to, and there's not much time left, that we're going to see the U.S. response to climate change dominated by the people who really do not want to change their operations. It's the, you know, great growth over everything. Technology will save us.
Right.
And that gets us into what corporations, you have an inside seat on it as well for a long time, watching what goes on in congressional committees and the rest of it and how the sausage is made. It seems to me that the companies have changed their tune a lot in the last 5 or 10 years, and really now, and they recognize that climate change is real and it will change everything, and they want that change of everything to make sure that they don't want to be the ones who lose out.
Right.
And it seems to me they have the power to really get a lot of things out of this Congress. Advanced nuclear is going to get money. The coal people are going to get money. The technology, Bill Gates' types who think technology can solve everything, just throw it, give it to the engineers and they'll solve it. You give it to the engineers and you get the military budget is what you get. Cost-plus contracts of bridges that can go nowhere and planes that have to be grounded after one test flight. I'm worried about that, John. And you've seen the corporate sector change. They really have responded. But I think they've responded in ways to make sure that they can maintain control. Anyway, that's my hypothesis.
Okay, sure. So corporations, giant corporations have dominated the U.S. economy and American politics really since the 1970s when they went global and when they also developed huge lobbying operations in Washington, D.C. We have a street in Washington called K Street. And when you say K Street in Washington, everybody knows that it means corporate lobbyists. Each big corporation has literally hundreds of lobbyists. So corporations are big. And Bill, as you indicated, we're in an interesting period of shift. 20 years ago, when everybody saw that tobacco was killing millions of people around the world, what did the tobacco companies do? Did they go away? No, they transformed into food companies. And now they kill you through unhealthy food. A similar thing has been happening in the big corporate world of fossil fuels. So fossil fuel companies have dominated the U.S. scene since the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Huge companies, they are global, huge political clout in Washington. And yes, the science as of 20 years ago was so unquestionable that fossil fuels, if we continued to pull it out of the ground and use it at the rate we were, was going to destroy the planet. And even though corporations are short-term thinkers, they think mainly about their profits on a quarterly basis, 3 months from now, they were able to see that this would be the end of them within 10 to 15 years if they didn't adapt. The Institute for Policy Studies, my institute, has an interesting project in New Mexico. We bring some of the best creative minds from New Mexico to Washington. We work with groups there. And it is an incredible microcosm of this. It is a state built on the fossil fuel industry, oil and gas, also the military. And the oil and gas companies there see the handwriting on the wall. The legislature in New Mexico has said we need an energy transition. So who's doing the transition? It is big global corporations, some of them fossil fuel, some of them other new companies, some of them not even from the United States. They are coming in and saying, we can do solar, we can do wind, and we face a giant crisis of democracy around that. Will we allow giant corporations to dominate that industry in New Mexico and in this country? Or can we create rules that give advantage to the thousands of small-scale energy democracy experiments in this country, co-ops, other community-owned efforts to take energy back into the hands of people? And there are many of those, by the way, cropping up in a place like New Mexico. So you are absolutely right, Bill. The big corporations are now trying to game the system and slant the rules in their favor so that they get to become the next phase of America's energy future. But they do it with the same giant size, which has both corrupted our politics and created a very difficult imbalance between those corporations and their workers and the communities they're in. Now, that's their plan. Happily, there is resistance, and this is where we're at with Joe Biden. There will be more of the money in the Biden plan will go towards clean energy than towards the alternatives, including coal and nuclear, although it is absurd that they include nuclear as part of what's clean. More will go into what you and I and your listeners would agree is clean energy, but the big question is, can the rules be written in a way in which energy democracy is favored and has a chance to flourish? Or will the rules be written in a way that we simply are going to shift from big oil to big wind and big solar?
Yeah, I didn't know the New Mexico story. I do try and follow the California story, which is
right.
So fascinating. I've said it before on the air, over half the customers, electricity customers in California are now served by public agencies, when half of those half are served by the long-established public utilities, like in Los Angeles, the Department of Power and Water, Sacramento, San Francisco, and 40 others. The other half have developed in the last 10 years, pursuant to law, they have taken over the electric supply responsibility from PG&E and Southern California Edison, and they are now running the energy systems. The problem, of course, is the IOUs, PG&E, for example, investor-owned utilities, are fighting back. They're very strong in the legislature. They're extremely strong in the Public Utility Commission that makes decisions as to how much money the public agencies have to pay them for the use of their lines. They
right.
will not sell their lines. San Francisco has tried to buy their lines. They say, no, we're going to soak you for the use of our old lines, electric lines and grid. It seems to me there's this enormous struggle going on in California now between the corporate utilities and their bankers who are worldwide.
Right.
Corporate bonds are, electricity bonds are the gold standard of, in investing. Every rich person has utility bonds that pay 6 or 7%, and by law, they're guaranteed. Anyway, it seems to me that that battle now, as you pointed out, the battle is everywhere, but it's insufficiently in California. It's one of their least covered big stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, Bill, I mean, just if I could comment on this for a moment, you have highlighted one of the most important battles of the next 10 years. I think the interesting thing here is the public in the United States has been greatly awakened to a part of the problem, the part which is we need a rapid transition from fossil fuels to clean and renewable energy. They get that. The other big awakening of the country over the past year is that we need a resurgence of democracy in this country, but most people think of that purely in the political realm. We need voting rights for people who Republican legislatures are trying to take it away from. So there's a real sense we need a big energy transition. There's a real sense we need to hang on to and revitalize our democracy. We have to fight against right-wing attacks or attempts to curtail it at the state level. What I think will come in the next few years is a combining of these two. Most people just see the energy fight as that simple. Save the planet, reduce carbon emissions, do this transition. And what you're highlighting and what many people I know on the grassroots level are arguing for is we need democracy also in our energy sector. And I think that will emerge as we get more and more money that is going into the transition, as the transition speeds up. I think people who are instinctively people in this country are suspicious of big power, big concentrated power. And we've seen all of its problems in so many different spheres. I think as this transition speeds up, the voices of those who are putting forward alternative models of community-owned power and what we could loosely call energy democracy will gain in strength. And the battles that you are encouraging, Bill, I think will come to communities all over the country. It's not here yet, but we need to talk about it now in order to prepare the battles of, you know, 2022, 2023, and 2024. And we're up against a formidable opponent, these giant both fossil fuel firms, the nuclear firms, the coal firms, of course, and other big energy firms that are coming in. So it's going to take a huge amount of resolve. But I think the trick is, or the challenge here, is can we turn what is a massive democracy movement in this country, can we expand its notion of what democracy entails from just from voting rights and political democracy to economic democracy and energy democracy?
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to John Cavanaugh. We've discussed the Biden American Jobs Plan that promises something for everyone and seems to invite the U.S. corporate apparatus to fund, that gives it at least a great chance for the U.S. corporate apparatus to fund their own modernization plan with a clean and green gloss to fund their plans with corporate money, which could, of course, be a death sentence for the planet. You've been right into the coming battle that's going to happen in the Congress over the American Jobs Plan. You're really familiar with, you're on the board, in fact, of the Progressive Caucus in Washington, the Congressional Progressive Caucus. It seems to me that our hope, and it's quite possible, is that the Congressional Caucus uses its leverage to make sure that a good deal of the money, in fact, goes to energy democracy. And that leads then to the question, how strong really are they? Can they be unified? To what extent are they in support of a variety of bills proposed by a number of senators and representatives? One of them is Jeff Merkley, who did quite a radical set of concepts. And the direction of the money would, in fact, go to energy democracy. Is the Congressional Progressive Caucus in support of Merkley and the others? Certainly some of the people are very strong and knowledgeable. Will they use their leverage, though? Tell us about that.
Sure. That's a great question, Bill, and it's an area of, I feel, great hope for progressives in this country. When Bernie Sanders was elected in 1991 as an independent congressman from Vermont, it was his idea to create a bloc that could create progressive power. So he was the creator of and first chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and it started with five people in 1991. It has grown to now 95 people at this moment, and it was given an amazing jolt of energy in these elections of sort of the Trump-inspired elections of progressives in 2018 and 2020. We got, in 2018, the squad, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley. We've got, in 2020, we got Cori Bush from Ferguson, and we got other progressives, great woman from New Mexico who is into energy democracy. We got three great progressives from New York State, and so on. So these are people, many of whom were organizers. The chair of the caucus is Pramila Jayapal from Washington State, from Seattle. She organized immigrant rights for many, many years. She also knows energy issues. She knows both labor and energy issues. She knows internationalist issues. She's committed to cutting the military budget. And coming out of organizing, she's a great organizer of this caucus. Now, the other thing they have on their side, so it's 95 members coming together around a very progressive agenda, Green New Deal, massive jobs plan, union rights, transforming our care economy in one that works for both parents with young kids as well as workers in that sphere. The other thing they have going for them is that what they're pushing for is very popular. So overwhelmingly, people want these big things we've just been talking about. And not only that, this is a new moment, I think, in U.S. politics. People are so mad that billionaires made money off the pandemic and that corporations paid their CEOs record amounts last year in a pandemic that these proposals are even more popular when you link them to taxing the rich and taxing corporations. So the Progressive Caucus, backed by a lot of progressive groups, are also pushing a very strong redistributive taxing of Wall Street, the wealthy, and corporations that would hit at the core of the inequality problem in this country. So that's the good news. Now, your specific question is, will they be good on the energy transition and on energy democracy? I want to say my sense of it is that about a third of them really know these issues. And this is in thanks to the Sunrise Movement. Many people will remember this, the moment when those great progressives were elected, AOC being the fourth member of the squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. One of her first acts was to join Sunrise. This is 2018. She stood up on a desk in Nancy Pelosi's office and waved the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is also, and the groups pushing it all over the country, are for energy democracy. She got it instinctually. She quickly became the most popular, if you will, and most followed member of that Congressional Progressive Caucus, along with Pramila Jayapal and the others. And so a huge amount of education has been done since 2018. And then you mentioned in the Senate counterparts would be Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley and a handful of others. These are people who've been greatly schooled, and I really want to give credit to the progressive movements that have turned more of their attention towards these elected officials and towards educating them. So Merkley does understand it. So do the progressives. Now, can they fight hard against the giant corporate interests when in the middle of the night? I mean, this is the way Congress works. This big bill will be put together, and in the last 24 hours, the corporate people will be in there lobbying. And now there's a counterpart, which is progressive groups and the caucus also pushing hard. And yes, I think on a number of the energy democracy issues, the progressives will draw a line in the sand and say these must be in there for us to vote for them. So I'm hopeful that some will get in there. And I'm also, though, I just want to say, this is why your radio show is so important. We need a lot more education on the energy democracy issues. So your work is critical on this, and all of the groups in the Climate Justice Alliance and other groups that are pushing for this. There's a Thrive Network that's pushing for Green New Deal-like legislation. We need to do massive education with the public to get them. They're at phase one. They know we need a major energy transition. We now need to get more of them to phase two to understand that this must be done democratically.
John Cavanaugh, thanks so much for talking to us. I hope in the next several months when this bill gets cobbled together that we'll come out of it with the resources that can show the planet and the people in the United States the use of those resources for demonstration projects of energy democracy, like in California and New Mexico, apparently, and Massachusetts. They're primed for it. That can show really the way to reduce fulminating climate roasting and save an inhabitable planet. John Cavanaugh, so good talking to you, and keep up the good work, and put your muscle to the grindstone. Or whatever you're supposed to do.
No, thanks so much, Bill, and the same to you. You are educating the public, and we're working in coalition with many groups to push these things, and we reinforce one another. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
It is Memorial Day, folks, and Howard Zinn reminds us that Memorial Day will be celebrated by the usual betrayal of the dead, by the hypocritical patriotism of the politicians and contractors preparing for more wars, more graves to receive more flowers on future Memorial Days. The memory of the dead deserves a different dedication, rightly, he preaches, to peace, to defiance of governments. In 1976, Howard Zinn published Whom Will We Honor Memorial Day? That appeared in the Boston Globe. It cost him his column, but the piece was published. Memorial Day, he says, will be celebrated as usual by high-speed collisions of automobiles and bodies strewn on highways and the sound of ambulance sirens throughout the land. It will also be celebrated by the display of flags, the sound of bugles and drums by parades and speeches and unthinking applause. It will be celebrated by giant corporations which make guns, bombs, fighter planes, aircraft carriers, an endless assortment of military junk, and which await billion-dollar contracts to be approved soon by Congress and the President. Yes, that was written in 1976, but it could have been written yesterday. He goes on, No politician who voted funds for war, no business contractor for the military, no general who ordered young men into battle, no FBI man who spied on anti-war activities should be invited to public ceremonies on this sacred day. Let the dead of the past wars be honored. Let those who live pledge themselves never to embark on mass slaughter again. Let us honor Martin Luther King, who refused the enticement of the White House and the cautions of associates and thundered against the war in Vietnam, and also Thoreau, who went to jail to protest the Mexican War, and Mark Twain, who denounced our war in the Philippines at the turn of the century, and I.F. Stone, who virtually alone among newspaper editors exposed the fraud and brutality of the Korean War. Memorial Day should be a day for putting flowers on graves and planting trees, also for destroying the weapons of death that endanger us more than they protect us, that waste our resources and threaten our children and grandchildren. Meanwhile, there is such a shortage of housing that millions live in dilapidated sections of our cities, and millions are forced to pay high rents, again, written in 1976, could have been written just yesterday. Howard Zinn concludes, "We must be practical, say those whose practicality has consisted of a war every generation. We mustn't deplete our defenses, say those who have depleted our youth, stolen our resources. In the end, it is living people, not corpses, creative energy, not destructive rage, which are our only real defense, not just against other governments trying to kill us, but against our own, also trying to kill us. Let us not set out this Memorial Day on the same old drunken ride to death." Again, that was Howard Zinn in 1976, an article published in the Boston Globe. Whom will we honor Memorial Day? Later on our program, we'll hear from Sharon Grant, who looks at vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers. But next on The Old Mole, in the final segment of a three-part interview, Louisa Martinez and Dr. Mitch Green return to the way economists frame the economic problem. That is, understanding the dynamics of a social provisioning process. They discuss what the heterodox school of economics has to say about the possibility for a non-capitalist economy.
Hey, everybody. Mi nombre es Luisa Martinez, and welcome to the third and last part of my interview with heterodox economist Dr. Mitch Green. Mitch is a PhD economist living in Portland, Oregon. He teaches classes at Portland Community College. He also researches and works on issues related to energy economics as a research scholar for the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. He's a first-generation college student, anti-imperialist army veteran, lover of dogs, and sits on the board of Clowns Without Borders as their economic advisor / elected hospital clown representative. Hey, Mitch. Thanks for talking to me.
Glad to be here again. Always a pleasure to find out what my hobbies are.
I want to just take the time to summarize the two visions of the economy that we've been talking about. So mainstream view is that the economy is fundamentally scarce. People are fundamentally self-interested. That markets, free market, right, is necessary to allocate those scarce resources. And that's just the best we got. Alternatively, with heterodox economics, the economy is a social provisioning process where key features are socially constructed, that we control them, and that resources are produced and not inherently scarce. And that is a much more open and discretionary view. So last time we spoke, we started to broach the subject of inflation, or more broadly, the limits of deficit spending. And, you know, we didn't really get into it. So I still don't understand why you're not worried about multi-trillion-dollar spending bills. Right. So keeping in line with the idea that we could afford things like universal health care and free college and federal jobs guarantee, that, you know, these multi-trillion-dollar spending bills, why you're not worried that they could result in inflation. And The reason why is because there's really clear examples in history of countries trying to kind of print their way out of budget crises and that not working out so well. So can you kind of bring some clarity?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is probably the biggest point of confusion, where like there's a gap between how I've approached explaining this and kind of where people are at in terms of thinking through the main issue at hand. And so let me bring us back to that household / government finance analogy problem as a sort of point of departure, because I think that's really critical in understanding how these limits are constructed. So it's true in the United States, for the case of the United States, I'm not worried about big inflationary episodes following a spate of like multi-trillion dollar spending packages. And that's primarily because of the way that we have structured our monetary institutions. We're not on a gold standard. We are not on a fixed exchange rate with another external currency. And so when the United States spends, creates new money by deficit spending, it doesn't do so with a promise to convert to anything besides dollars. And so in a sense, it doesn't have a fixed promise that would place it in the same basket as household does, like where we have to collect dollars before we can spend.
So wait, just to recap, last time we talked about how a personal budget that you can't project kind of the constraints that we all have as individuals when it comes to a household budget, right? We go to work, we get a paycheck, we use that to spend bills. That's not the way that the federal treasury works, because we only have one experience, you said, of something that are two different experiences. We only have the experience of a currency user, and that's distinct. That's very, very different from a currency creator. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Right. And so when I'm talking about the possibilities for federal spending, I'm going from the perspective of the currency issuer, right? The federal government is the currency issuer. So it can always afford anything for sale in dollars. What really matters, though, is what is the effect of that spending on the economy? And will it create bottlenecks, shortages, or will it expand productive capacity? Let's suppose we went out and did a big spending bill that kind of massively increased public housing. Free at the point of service, free at the point of housing, you know, Medicare for all, student loan forgiveness, a Green New Deal, forgiveness of international debts, and just a huge grab bag of a big, you know, progressive or quasi-socialist policy objectives, that would end up relaxing the constraints on many of the sort of things that sort of everyday people have as an experience in their household budget. And so you don't get squeezed when you create resources in that regard, right? And you sort of, you send a signal to the rest of the economy that says we are going to have a long period of growth. And so you see investment in more productive capacity, and you sort of increase your ability to generate resources. Okay, but it's not always the case that deficit spending does that. It could also end up being in a situation that shoots you in the foot, right? And that's what I was trying to get towards last time when we talked about how it's important to think about specific supply chains and whether or not they have enough slack in them or the capacity to sort of absorb big changes in demand. And so last time I had said, look, we are currently experiencing little sort of episodic or pointed high price events or shortages, like in lumber or trying to go buy a new car. It's because we left to the private sector the problem of infrastructure provisioning for a really long time. And so they didn't build enough capacity to supply us with the stuff we need today. But that again that's not a forever thing. That can always be changed if we change policy. And money can be used to serve that goal. So I want to take us to the experience of some of these headline hyperinflationary moments in history, where folks go to immediately when I talk about deficit spending as being sort of like, quote unquote, printing money or engendering this idea that, you know, the sky's the limit on anything that we can do. Because we kind of tend to think, well, actually, there have been moments where that wasn't the case. And it caused folks to have to go out with wheelbarrows of cash to sort of go down the street and buy a loaf of bread. I mean, clearly you're lying to me, Mitch. And I want to point out that those were very different experiences and institutional arrangements than what the United States currently has. In Weimar Germany, where you had hyperinflation, that was a situation where post Treaty of Versailles, you had significant reparations on Germany and their ability to produce stuff. And they had significant debts in an external currency because the Allied victors placed these kind of onerous conditions on them that they could not meet, even under the best of conditions. And so trying to spend your way out of that while ignoring that external constraint causes that hyperinflationary problem. You might be in a war-torn country where a famine is going on and also owe debts in an external currency. So if you try to print your way out of that, you're going to have a hyperinflation episode, right? Or finally, if you look at a country like Venezuela and you see like hyperinflation or rapid inflation going on in the Bolivar, it's important to recognize that that currency is on a pegged fixed exchange relationship, even if it gets adjusted, with dollars. And it's a desire to earn petrodollars in order to generate revenues from international trade. And that's set against a context where there's significant sanctions and constraints on the
ability.
Hold on,
sorry. Every time I say sanctions, my friends in Venezuela insist I use the term unilateral coercive measures because okay. Sanction implies that more than one country wants to do them. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I felt pressure to interrupt you. I just wanted to talk more.
That's fair.
I wanted to reflect it in the notes.
Yeah. I'm not tied to any language here. So the substantive point here is that sometimes a specific nation state or country is under the thumb of a set of coercive relationships that can undermine their ability to use monetary relationships or relations to steward resources. Okay, you can't ignore these power dynamics. And so in those cases, you want to think about those experiences as if they're users of a currency, not issuers of a currency. And so inflation is a really tricky concept. I think most of us think about inflation as if you double the money supply, then you've halved the purchasing power of your currency in proportion, right? And that's just not how it works. That's a kind of, it's a naive story about how it works. In the real world, inflation is the result of a very complicated set of responses in the economy to changes in prices and costs. And prices are administered by firms, corporations, or in some cases, governments. And sometimes they pass on costs and higher prices. Sometimes they absorb them. But you want to think about inflation as being the abdication or the relaxation or the failure to regulate certain industrial aspects of your society rather than simply an automatic response to the fiscal authorities going out and trying to spend.
And you're saying that the reason why we wouldn't have necessarily is that type of problem in the United States is because the U.S. is a sovereign country. I mean, the United States is true sovereignty.
Yeah, it's on many, across many different measures, but I'm speaking most specifically in terms of its currency. So we simply we're not at the behest of any other place in the world as to how we regard our dollar. So it's just completely up to the Treasury.
So just, you know, if you had to give a last thought in terms of the people listening, and if there's one idea that they should, that you might encourage them to purge from their minds in terms of preconceived notions about how the economy works, what would you urge them?
Yeah, I would like to remind folks that we live inside of capitalism. We live inside of a market society. And sometimes it can be really hard to see outside of the structures and institutions that make up that society. And so there's an impulse to project upon all of history and time the things that seem commonplace today as if they are natural phenomenon. And so going back to this distinction between how heterodox economists view what I call the social provisioning process versus the way, say, a neoclassical or mainstream economist views economics as just being about allocation of scarce resources in markets, is that we have a much bigger problem to contend with, and there's much more possibilities open to us as human beings in how we choose to arrange the specific social practices and institutions that you know produce our resources, engage in reproduction of our technologies and our systems of production, and then figure out how to distribute all that. These are all very much subject to social construction, mediation, and we can always devise a different system as long as we have the technology to do so. And so that's why I said in the beginning that as long as a thing is technologically possible, you can always find a way to pay for it. It's because the money thing is just, it's just a social relationship and an institution like anything else. And so we shouldn't think of that as being the limiting factor if we're thinking about production and distribution as sort of an international project of solidarity, right? We can always find ways to be in coalition with our working class comrades around the world to figure out how we share our resources and build an equitable, sustainable, and just society.
Mitch Green, economist / real hippie. So thank you. Really appreciate the time.
You don't get to call me a hippie. You can call me a lot of things, but not that.
Okay. Thanks.
Could have been anything that we wanted to be, and it's not too late to change. I'd be delighted to give it some thought. Maybe you'll agree that we really aren't 2, 3, 4. We could have been anything that
conclude today's program with Sharon Grant looking at vaccine hesitancy among healthcare workers. Sharon was a longtime public employee with Multnomah County and worked on vaccine hesitancy community campaigns for the health department. Sharon?
This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I spent more than 20 years at the Multnomah County Health Department. Some of that time as a health educator preparing educational materials around vaccine hesitancy for patients, and some as a community health worker in the clinic system. So the article I'm about to read excerpts from is of particular interest to me. It is from the February 2, 2021 New Yorker article titled, "Why Are So Many Healthcare Workers Resisting the COVID Vaccine?" by Dhruv Kular, a practicing physician and an assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College. The article begins. Tiffany Chance has worked as a certified nursing assistant since 2005. As an African American in her mid-30s, Chance typifies the demographics of her profession. Most CNAs are young, over a third are Black, 90% are women. Chance started picking up scattered shifts through IntelliCare, a staffing agency that allows healthcare workers to choose jobs the way Uber drivers accept riders. She often works 6 shifts a week, 8 or 12 hours each, across several nursing homes. When considering a shift, Chance, who has asthma, tries to choose nursing homes without active coronavirus spread. This information, however, is self-reported, and there's often a delay. I'd pick a place that said they don't have the virus, then I'd show up and they'd say, "Actually, some of these people have COVID," Chance told me. In early October, she scheduled a shift at a new facility, which she was told had no coronavirus positive residents. She was given a surgical mask, not an N95 respirator. A week later, as she started to develop a runny nose, she received a call. A resident had tested positive. Soon, her breathing worsened. "God, it was terrible," she said. "I felt like an elephant was sitting on my chest. I couldn't walk an inch without getting out of breath." As the weeks wore on, she turned to family for help with food and money for rent. "I kept thinking, you work this hard, you care for so many people, and when you get sick, this is how you're treated." While navigating bureaucratic hurdles, Chance's symptoms worsened. During one especially rough night, she considered going to the hospital, but the following morning, her breathing eased, and slowly it returned to normal. Chance is convinced that her illness didn't get worse only because a few years ago she'd received the pneumonia vaccine. "I really think it helped," she said. "That vaccine saved me." Chance doesn't want a coronavirus vaccine. I asked her how she had come to believe that one vaccine saved her life, but another threatens her health. "The vaccine came out too fast," she said. "I think they removed a lot of barriers to get it done faster." She continued, "It's not that I don't believe they're trying to do a good job. I just don't believe there's been enough research yet. There's no way they've been studying it for long enough." Beyond the speed of development, Chance has questions about how long vaccine-generated immunity lasts, about how serious the long-term side effects might be, and about what could happen if the virus mutates further. Until these questions are answered to her satisfaction, she has no plans to get immunized. "I'm not saying never," Chance told me. "I'm just saying not now." Despite confronting damage of COVID-19 firsthand and doing work that puts them and their families at high risk, healthcare workers express similar levels of vaccine hesitancy as people in the general population. Recent surveys suggest that overall, around a third of healthcare workers are reluctant to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Around 1 in 5 Americans say they probably definitely won't get vaccinated nationwide. Hesitancy is more common among Republicans, rural residents, and people of color. The rates are higher in certain regions, professions, and racial groups. Black healthcare workers, for instance, are more likely to have tested positive for the virus, but less likely to want a vaccine. 35% turned down a first dose. Compared with doctors and nurses, other health professionals, EMTs, home health aides, therapists, are generally less likely to say they'll get immunized, and a recent survey of CNAs found that nearly 3/4 were hesitant to get the vaccine. The hesitancy is less outright rejection than cautious skepticism. It's driven by suspicions about the evidence supporting the new vaccines and about the motives for endorsing them. The astonishing speed of vaccine development has made science a victim of its own success. After being told that it takes years, if not decades, to develop vaccines, many healthcare workers are reluctant to accept one that sprinted from conception to injection in less than 11 months. They simply want to wait to see longer-term safety data, or at least to find out how their colleagues fare after inoculation. Another major hurdle is mistrust of both the political and the healthcare systems. The problem is most acute in historically marginalized communities, which already live with racial disparities in life expectancy, maternal mortality, access to medical care, representation in clinical trials, informed consent, the physician workforce, and COVID-19 outcomes. It's exacerbated among healthcare workers who are underrepresented and poorly paid. David Grabowski, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard, told me, "In many cases, vaccine hesitancy is not a lack of information problem. It's a lack of trust problem. Staff doesn't trust leadership. They have real skepticism of government. They haven't gotten hazard pay. They haven't gotten PPE. They haven't gotten respect. Should we be surprised that they're skeptical of something that feels like it's being forced on them?" Kimberly Delbo has been the director of nursing services and innovation at an assisted living facility in central Pennsylvania for 3 years. "The most important thing we can do as an organization is make sure people know that we truly care about them. In an industry where 50% of annual staff turnover rate is not uncommon, Delbo's facility did not lose a single employee in 2019. Last year, it had 90% retention rate. During the pandemic, employees have had access not only to adequate protective gear, but also to what she calls the healthcare hero's room, complete with a massage chair, aromatherapy, antioxidant drinks, and fresh fruits and vegetables. They work hard, she said. They deserve a tranquil environment. Like staff at nursing homes across the country, those at Delbo's facility are split on whether to get vaccinated. Delbo has made educating residents and staff a central priority. We've been very proactive about building confidence in it, about getting them the facts, about debunking conspiracy theories and social media myths, she said. We can engage in this dialogue because they trust us. I think what's important for people to understand is that you don't build trust in a day, and you don't build it for a specific purpose. We've been investing in trust for years. We're doing this before the pandemic, and we'll do it after. This is Sharon Grant, reading from the February 2nd, 2021 New Yorker article titled, Why Are So Many Healthcare Workers Resisting the COVID Vaccine?
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. A big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this past year. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible, Bill Resnick and John Cavana, Luisa Martinez and Dr. Mitch Green, and Sharon Grant. John Nelson edited portions of today's program. You can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or you can download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. The Mole's perspective is democratic, broadly socialist, feminist, and anti-racist. I am Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective.